Welcome to the Providence College Podcast. As we approach the anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on April 4th, we bring you this lecture by Philip Peduti Jr. This alum of the Graduate History Program has taught history at Quinnipiac University and won awards as a history teacher at Summers High School in Connecticut. Peduti is the author of three books, and the most recent is titled RFK and MLK, Visions of Hope, 1963 to 1968. In January, he explored how emotion and Dr. King's philosophy shaped the civil rights movement in a presentation for the college's Humanities Forum as part of MLK Convocation Week.
It is so amazing to be here, I have to tell you, and it's also so amazing to see some of my former students from Summers High School sitting in the front row. First of all, I'd like to thank Nancy Kelly, Wanda Ingram, and the members of the Humanities Forum for asking me to be here today. I also want to thank Pamela Belcher, Tara Baxter, Patrick Breen, and Joanne McNamara for welcoming me back to Providence College. As you already mentioned, I graduated with a master's degree in 1998 from here. Professor O'Malley is in attendance. Where is he? All right, Professor O'Malley, I want to thank you and all my professors who I had here for your inspiration and guidance. They were a big part of my journey that led me to this stage. So thank you very much. And all of you students, your professors are amazing here. You can learn a lot from them, as I'm sure you already know. When I was a student, I actually came to this room and the Civil War historian James McPherson spoke right from this stage. It's all right, that happens to me all the time. No problem at all. I remember watching him, and I actually wrote an article for the Providence Journal Bulletin on that, and I remember saying, I want to be that guy someday where I can talk to students and I can make a difference. So it's really nice to be up here on this stage and actually have this opportunity. So, and I endeavored to contribute to this field in some sort of way, some sort of meaningful way. Let's talk a little bit about what we're going to do today and how we're going to approach Dr. King. These are my three books behind me. And I thought when we're looking at King and what we're going to explore today are the words that he used in the speeches, public appearances. All of that came from my own research, which actually started here in these halls with Margaret Manchester. I took a course in American Foreign Relations, and I started to explore John Kennedy. I went ahead and I ended up doing more research on Kennedy, which ultimately became my first book, Kennedy's Kitchen Cabinet and the Pursuit of Peace. So it all started here. When I looked at the research, looked at primary sources, and I started to appreciate really examining a close read of words and what words mean and how they impact history. But in the midst of that research for this book, I discovered, although I always knew he was there, but I discovered Bobby Kennedy. Now, Bobby Kennedy is a pretty interesting person, and I'm partial to Bobby as opposed to Jack. Don't tell him that, but that's just how it is. He actually spoke here long ago. There's some pictures of him over in Harkins. Now, Bobby Kennedy is a very interesting individual, and with that research, I was looking at his oral histories on John Kennedy, and there was a whole bunch of stuff on civil rights. So I took pictures of all those, and I told myself I was going to come back and do something on civil rights later. Which brings me to my second book, which that book is about how the Kennedy brothers and their New Frontier rhetoric, coupled with their support of the law as it had been defined since the Brown versus the Board of Education, changed the climate of the nation to accept the actions of African Americans, bringing a greater awareness to this country about these issues, the issues that we're going to talk about today. And through that examination, I started looking at Dr. King. And I started really looking at Dr. King and really trying to understand what his words mean, which led me to my third book, which was a clear examination of his rhetoric and his philosophy. And I found myself enamored by King, and I had always been fascinated by King and by his story, but that close examination of language and the close examination of rhetoric is something that really brought home how important these people were. So today we're going to take another piece that I've been working on, and that's emotions history. So I want to explore how emotion and Dr. King's philosophy shaped the civil rights movement. I'm currently working on a PhD, and I'm examining how emotional communities played a role in the presidency of John Kennedy. And in that study, I examined systems of feeling and how they shaped Kennedy's decision-making, beginning with his family relationships, continuing with his experience in war, and ultimately his time in public office. So I'm hoping to bring a similar approach, a similar methodology to civil rights, to the civil rights movement and to the study of the civil rights movement. The civil rights movement is wrought with emotion, ranging from anger to hope to despair to even jubilation sometimes. Dr. King was part of a system of feeling that served as a thread within the movement that brought many of these ideas together. His use of emotion specifically evoked a sense of hope. A sense of hope in the 1960s when they really needed it. And I think we can take that hope. We can take those ideas and we can use that emotion to attack some of the issues that we deal with in the 21st century. I think we need to focus a little more on King's words, on what he had to say. And that's what we're going to do today. We're going to at least try. Now, King wasn't the only voice in the movement. He's the one that I focus a lot of energy on, but I really want to be clear. This movement involved a myriad of voices. I call it a chorus of voices. And if we had more time, we can look at all the voices. But since we're at a college, I thought it would be especially important to talk about some students. Students who made a difference in this movement, and students who were affected by Dr. King's philosophies. So over here we have the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. John Lewis is right here. Now John Lewis by far is one of my favorite people ever. He marched at Selma in 65. He was one of the Freedom Riders. He was part of the sit-in movement. This man is the real deal. And if you ever have an opportunity to meet him, take it and relish it. And I'd like to do that someday. I reached out to him years ago, but I haven't been able to make that connection. I just want to have coffee with the man, that's all. Now, John Lewis, he experienced deep moments of despair and great joy at times. And I remember him in 2008 when I was watching the election of President Obama, and he had been interviewed, and he had a difficult time talking because he was just crying. Because this is what he worked for, and this is what Dr. King talked about. He's the last of the Big Six to speak at the March on Washington. I'm telling you, he's an American hero. The other person that we can talk about as a part of this course is Diane Nash. Now, Diane Nash went to great lengths to challenge segregation, and she was the backbone of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. She's the one who got the students back on the Freedom Rides after the first wave had been sent to Louisiana. She provided leadership that drove a movement and challenged power when it was appropriate to challenge that power. She participated in the sit-ins, and she was also a voice, and she was there with Dr. King in Selma, and her future husband, James Bevel, was also a part of that. We could also consider Stokely Carmichael. I really like Stokely Carmichael. He has a great deal of passion and a great deal of conviction. And there's a lot of emotion there, and I think there's a lot we can learn from that. He coined the phrase black power. Much to King's dismay, by the way, King was not a fan of, well, he wasn't a fan of black power. He at one point said, you know, I believe in striped power. But part of it was King was committed to nonviolence, and he wanted to keep that commitment to nonviolence. So Carmichael demanded action not only from his government, but also from the people who he led, which was a little different than Dr. King. But today, I thought it was important, especially for all you students, to see that these guys made a difference, and this is something you could aspire to do as well. Well, let's get back to Dr. King for a minute. Because he's the voice in that chorus that I really want to hone in on. A voice that resonated from Lincoln Memorial in 1963, envisioning a new nation, envisioning a dream. In an effort to reflect on his dream, this forum will consider a few different moments in his lifetime where he confronted justice, poverty, and war. In an effort to use those moments as a roadmap for the issues that we confront today, we will closely examine those emotions within his words. And as I always tell my students, words matter. Words are important. And Dr. King's words are his greatest legacy. They can help us navigate the issues that we confront. And as a teacher of history, I always hope to inspire my students with the stories of yesterday in the hopes of creating a better tomorrow. So we're going to try to do that today. And before Dr. King died, he had commented a couple of times about how his dream had become a nightmare. And so I guess my question to all of you is, will that dream always remain elusive to us? And I don't think so. I firmly believe that King's dream is still possible, and it's up to all of us in this room, the students of the 21st century. Like Lewis, Nash, and Carmichael, you're the next stewards of his dream. You're the next ones who could actually take it to the next level. So today I'm hoping to arm all of you with words of love and nonviolence in that endeavor. Dr. King will guide us, but he can only take us so far. But it's up to the students in this room to realize that better world that he had dreamed of in 1963. Speaking of 1963, that was by far one of the most pivotal years of the civil rights movement, especially for Dr. King, pardon me. Let's take a moment and look at an event that catapulted King into the national consciousness. Now, King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference had been involved in a few movements since the Montgomery bus boycott. He had faced death several times in his life, and in one moment, at one point, his house had been bombed during the Montgomery bus boycott. Luckily, his wife Coretta and his daughter Yolanda was in the back of the house, and it was the front of the house that actually had been bombed. During that movement, and this is an important moment in his life that I want to talk a little bit about, because we're going to come back to it. He had come home one night, and some of you may have heard this before because he spoke about it publicly, and I used to listen to the speech just to kind of listen to him and see what he had to say. He had come home one night and he had received a phone call telling him that if he didn't stop, they were going to blow his brains out and blow up his house and hurt his family. And it had really rattled King, especially given the fact that his family threatened. And at this point in the movement, he had considered actually having armed guards. And then it was after this moment that he said, we're not doing this anymore. He was committed to nonviolence. And it was Bayard Rustin who actually really said, look, we need to focus on nonviolence. You know, Rustin was a pretty strong advocate. He was a part of the Congress of Racial Equality. So King had gotten that phone call, and he had been rattled, and he thought, I'm going to make some coffee to kind of calm my nerves and to really just focus. And it was over that cup of coffee that he had prayed. He had prayed for strength. He had prayed for guidance. Prayed that I believe what I'm doing is right. And he talks about how in that moment, over that cup of coffee at his kitchen table, he had felt God tell him that he would be with him, that the Lord would protect him in his journey. And it was from that moment on, he said that he didn't fear anything, that he knew what he was doing was right, and he was going to do God's will. Now, that's an important moment for Dr. King, and it happened really early on in the civil rights movement. And I want you to think of that moment as we look at Birmingham, as we look at all of these other moments where he put himself out there and he made a huge difference for the movement through his words. So by 1963, he felt he needed to do more to bring the movement into the mainstream consciousness of the nation. So he chose Birmingham, Alabama, as the place for this action. The city was known for its racist sheriff, Eugene Bull Connor, and King wanted the cameras to see the pernicious violence of segregation. planned a series of boycotts and protests. Now, he was scrutinized for his decision to act in Birmingham. The government was on the verge of changing. They had just been elected, and there was going to be a guard, if you will. And a lot of people said that he should wait. But King did not want to wait. On April 12th, which was Good Friday, he marched in violation of an injunction and was put in jail with his trusted lieutenant, Reverend Ralph Abernathy. From that jail cell, he wrote a letter that we're going to consider today. It's commonly referred to as a letter from the Birmingham jail. actually, Barack Obama had posted a tweet about the letter from the Birmingham jail. And he often reads it, he says, for its poetic brilliance, moral clarity, and tests of conscience. This is an important moment, and I often call it the poetry of the civil rights movement. From that jail cell, he wrote the letter defending his position why he needed to act. He said, "I am in Birmingham because injustice is here. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham." And then he wrote something that spoke to one of a major theme in his philosophy. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice anywhere. Went on to write that he saw the nation as a network of mutuality tied in a single garment of destiny. He believed in this interconnectedness among people, that the actions of one can make a difference for many. Not only was he speaking about this connection, but he was inclusive of all Americans, both black and white. He wanted everyone at the table to find a solution. This is a theme that we're going to revisit again, and it's a common thread within a lot of his writings. And it's something that I think we can use today. It's something that this interconnectedness, that we are all one and we should all work together, is an important point. The emotion in this letter is perhaps the most powerful, and you can see it there within the interconnectedness. He wanted people to empathize with his experience, what he felt when he saw injustice, why he could no longer wait to confront injustice. He said, "When you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers at will and drown your brothers and sisters at whim, when you have seen hate-filled policemen curse, kick, and even kill your black brothers and sisters, can't wait." King wanted to speak to both white and black leaders as he was being criticized on both sides. His words were meant to evoke emotions, those who read it. Perhaps the greatest example, at least I think, is when he talked about his daughter, who just wanted to go to an amusement park. He wrote, "When you suddenly find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering, as you seek to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she can't go to the public amusement park that has just been advertised on television, and see tears welling up in her eyes when she is told that Funtown is closed to colored children, and see ominous clouds of inferiority beginning to form in her little mental sky, and see her beginning to distort her personality by developing an unconscious bitterness toward white people." He felt he could not wait. He wanted to act not only for his little girl, but for all children, for the future of the nation, for my children, for our children. That's how he wanted this to change everything, for that dream that he would articulate in August of that same year. He finished saying, "When you go forever fighting a degenerating sense of nobodiness, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait." There are a myriad of emotions in this letter, and I'm only touching base on a few. There's anger, there's disbelief, there's feeling like a failed father. Those emotions are testament to a time where African Americans struggled a great deal, where they would have to sleep in their cars on a cross-country trip because they weren't allowed in certain hotels. Despite those feelings of despair, anger, and frustration, King never faltered in his beliefs of nonviolence, which is the other theme that we really should touch on. Not only did he believe that we're all interconnected, but he had a firm faith in nonviolence. And he believed in a Christian ideal of love and forgiveness and that in the end, nonviolence would win. Now, this was a pretty successful campaign for Dr. King. Birmingham protests would eventually lead to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. I often call this the Uncle Tom's Cabin of the Civil Rights Movement, which was Harriet Beecher Stowe's best-selling novel that exposed the horrific reality of slavery, not only to the United States, but to the world. Birmingham did the same thing for segregation and the racism of the 1960s. Scenes of dogs biting into students and water hoses chipping away at bricks while it hit huddled masses of students brought the nation to a new place with their beliefs about race and justice. So Birmingham was turning point in this movement. In fact, when President Kennedy saw this picture on the front page of the New York Times, he had commented that it had made him sick, and he wanted to do something about it. And just a couple of months later, he'll give a speech on civil rights that changes civil rights from a political issue to a moral issue, which was a very big deal for this country at the time. Just after that speech, King gives his famous I Have a Dream speech, which I was tempted to look at today, but I wanted to focus on more obscure moments, you know, stuff that you guys don't really know too much about, stuff that we don't talk enough about. But this moment on the steps of Lincoln Memorial enshrined his ideals into American history. It's an ever-fixed mark that we can all look to for an idealist vision of the nation. You can even go there and stand on the spot, which I brought students there, and we have stood on that spot. That's what that, really can't see it, but that's what that I Have a Dream is right there. It's about halfway up. I've taken my students there. I've taken my own children there. Speech, for one second, that speech is rooted in emotion. There's a ton of it in there. There's the whole notion of a check that he was coming to cash 100 years later after the Emancipation Proclamation, and it was marked insufficient funds. And that whole theme was the beginning of his speech. And perhaps the most memorable part is his I Have a Dream, which a lot of people don't realize was actually ad-libbed on the moment. It was Mahalia Jackson in the front row that said, you know, tell him about the dream, Martin. And if you watch the speech, you'll see that he stops reading from the piece of paper and he looks out and he gives the I Have a Dream speech. Remarkable, remarkable man. So I would recommend that you go there, stand on that spot, you know, stand in the footsteps of history for a second and just take it in. Because the following year, he wins the Nobel Peace Prize. Continuing his devotion to love and nonviolence, there's a lot we can take from this speech, but I'm just going to hit on a couple of things here. One is this notion of unarmed truth. Unarmed truth is an important phrase for Dr. King. I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality, he said. This is why right temporarily defeated is stronger than evil triumphant. Saw this movement as almost a war of attrition, nonviolent action based in love. He had always planned a continuous fight regardless of the opposition or the scrutiny, regardless of the defeat or the setbacks. He believed that he was right and just in his cause, and that's what kept him moving. We can take something from that, and we'll talk more about that later. With this speech, he becomes a world figure, someone for everybody to look to, and in my opinion, one of the most influential Americans in all of history. Now, he also celebrated his philosophy in that speech by saying, after contemplation, I conclude that this award, which I receive on behalf of that movement, has a profound recognition that nonviolence is the answer to the crucial political and moral question of our time, the need for man to overcome oppression and violence without resorting to violence and oppression. King believed that, quote, sooner or later, all the people in the world will have to discover a way to live together in peace, thereby transform this cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of brotherhood. His prose was majestic, getting to the core of his beliefs, invigorating the movement, demonstrating to the world that there was hope, and his vision will lead the way. As a testament to the power of this message, President Barack Obama alluded to this speech, his final State of the Union address in 2016, 52 years later. It's just one of those moments that when I was studying King, I took a second and I'm like, wow, this is an amazing speech and this is an amazing moment in the movement. And I tried to really dig into that and really understand what those words meant. And a lot of his most famous quotes come from that speech and come from the letter from the Birmingham jail. But now, so we have letter from the Birmingham jail, we have all these moments. After the Kennedy assassination, things changed a little bit. That happened very abruptly in November of 1963. In the wake of that assassination, King becomes even more relevant, even more important in this vacuum of leadership and as Americans grieved for a fallen leader. He had even commented to Coretta when he was watching the news reports of President Kennedy's assassination that this is what's going to happen to me. This society is at a point where this movement will only end in violence. So as he started to redefine his philosophy and it started to mature, which a lot of scholars see this as more of a radical king, more of a king that had seen things not quite going in the way of his I Have a Dream speech had expected, goes to Chicago. This is an important moment in his teachings. He goes to Chicago because while he's known for his work to confront racial injustice, he was also a strong advocate for addressing poverty and economic inequality. And he tried to do that in Chicago. Let's go to Soldiers Field in July of 1966. It's 98 degrees out, by the way. And King decided that he was going to challenge the racist institutions in the North that perpetuated poverty. He had listened to stories of impoverished African Americans living in cities. And after the Watts riots, and after he toured Watts, and after he saw what violence could do, he was even more committed to nonviolence. But he understood the frustration and anger that he heard from the people he spoke to. Empathy was a huge piece of what made him such a successful leader. We can take something from that too. He said to the crowd there at Soldiers Field, "We are tired of being seared in the flame of withering injustice. We are tired of living in rat-infested slums." This was part of his Chicago movement, where King hoped to expose the conditions in the city in the same way he exposed segregation in the South. Many have commented how confronting Bull Connor was easier than confronting the infrastructural racist tendencies of northern cities. King decided to adopt a new philosophy. He moved into an apartment where he wanted to make a difference, and he tried to live there. He broke bread with them. He visited with them. They visited him. They saw him on the street. They took time to get to know him. While his speaking engagements still kept him busy, he still came back, and he still made an effort there. Now, in the backdrop of all this, there was another thread beginning to develop in the civil rights movement. And that was this militant movement that Carmichael talks a little bit about in Black Power, but we see it with the Black Panthers. We certainly see it with Malcolm X. By this point, Malcolm X had been assassinated. And it was born from the frustration that despite the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act, it seems that things were not changing in this nation. So on that July day in 1966, King spoke to the people of Chicago not only to confront injustice and expose poverty, but also to maintain that nonviolence was the only way for this movement to go forward. King understood that violence would only lead to further divide the people of this nation, making it difficult to gain a coalition, what he called a coalition of conscience, that he strived to bring lasting social change. He said on that day, "We must work passionately and unrelentingly for first-class citizenship, but we must never use second-class citizenship to get it." He said to the crowd, "I understand our impatience. We have been victims of so many broken promises and deferred dreams. but I do not see the answer to our problems in violence. While nonviolence was his main approach to confront issues, King also touched base on that second theme that I really want to hit home with. He said, our power is in our unity, the force of our souls, and the determination of our bodies. This is a force that no army can overcome, for there is nothing more powerful in all the world than a surge of unarmed truth. Let's talk about that for a minute, unarmed truth. I love that phrase, by the way. And he uses this more after the Kennedy assassination than he does before, which I'm not even sure if he uses it, but he talks about it briefly, I think, in the letter from the Birmingham jail. Unarmed meaning nonviolent. Truth meaning righteous. He wanted us to confront all of these issues with love and with unarmed truth. So when you hear that, it's a very powerful phrase for Dr. King, because it really sums up what he believes we could be doing. To give it power, he said, I watched it crush the sagging walls of bus segregation in Montgomery, Alabama. I watched it stand before violent dogs and powerful water hoses in Birmingham, Alabama, with a strength and endurance that forced the nation to write a revolutionary civil rights bill. That's what unarmed truth can do. This speech set the tone for a new phase in the movement, especially in Chicago, but it was meant to define his actions in the North as they confronted a different kind of racism. The words he used to describe Montgomery and Birmingham are meant to evoke a sense of empowerment. Those were battles that were won. He wanted to empower the people of the North with love, nonviolence, and unarmed truth. He also wanted to stress that we are all connected, and he comes back to that other piece by saying, so let us all, white and black alike, see that we are tied in a single garment of destiny. Single garment of destiny. This is another one of my favorite phrases. Brilliant, and it's beautiful all at the same time. Think about it for a second, like really think about it. A single garment. So the garment is made up of threads. And threads individually are easily broken. But if you put those threads together, you have strength, you have unity. You can do almost anything. And I like how we use a single garment as if one, almost like a blanket, like something to cover us, something to heal us, something to make it better. This is an important piece of imagery, and it's supposed to evoke certain emotions when he says it. In the midst of combating growing voices that had advocated militant confrontation, King wanted to stress a philosophy based in love. While Birmingham and Chicago were 3 years apart, they had similar emotions that King used to evoke change, especially with his themes of nonviolence and interconnectedness. So that was 1966. So as many of you know, in the 1960s, the war in Vietnam had been waging. By 66, 67, we're looking at approximately 500,000 American troops over in Vietnam. The war itself had become a devastating aspect to the American psyche in a lot of ways. So for the final moment that I really want to look at, that I want to dive into, I want to look at a speech that he gave on April 4th, 1967, exactly 1 year before his assassination. King gave a speech at Riverside Church in New York City that spoke out against the war. This is something that he had been thinking about for some time, and he had decided finally that he was going to make a broad statement regarding his position on Vietnam. It's commonly referred to as Beyond Vietnam. That's and he would publish it later under that title. This speech is a culmination of all three threads that we are exploring: injustice, poverty, and war. In fact, he sees them all connected in this speech. And in my opinion, despite the criticism he received afterwards, I think it's one of his greatest speeches. He said, a time comes when silence is betrayal, and that time has come for us in relation to Vietnam. continued to talk about his path getting to this position by saying, over the past 2 years, I have moved to break the betrayal of my own silences and speak from the burnings of my own heart, as I have called for radical departures from the destruction in Vietnam. He saw the Vietnam War not only affecting the people of Vietnam, but also affecting people at home, because it was taking away resources that could have been used for us here, but it was also putting Americans in harm's way. And so he saw it as all connected, all a part of that garment of destiny that he spoke about. He said, America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor, so long as adventures like Vietnam continue to draw men and skills and money, like some demonic, destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and attack it as such. So after linking the war to a drainage of resources, he moves on to nonviolence. And he says this, which I thought was very poignant. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. He was advocating nonviolence. The people in those cities would ask King, what about Vietnam? He said, those questions started to hit home with me. And I said, well, and he said, I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence, my own government. He concluded that for the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent. In this speech, he attacked war and its barbarity, linking once again this theme of interconnectedness and nonviolence. He said, we still have a choice today, nonviolent coexistence or violent co-annihilation. Now that's a powerful statement from Dr. King in a very powerful time. Think about it for a minute. Think about the 1960s. Violent co-annihilation. The human race, according to him, in order to survive, needed to come together. Now this is in the backdrop of a time where nuclear war was we're in the midst of the Cold War. The Cuban Missile Crisis happened in 1962. People were worried about nuclear war. People were building fallout shelters. Now he was trying to touch on that emotion. He was trying to say, look, we're already close, people. We're already almost there. We need to figure out a way to work together or we're gonna destroy ourselves. One of my other favorite quotes that he said, we must all learn to live together as brothers or we most assuredly will perish together as fools. Something along those lines. He was invoking fear into this speech, which wasn't what he usually did, but he understood that the stakes were high and he felt the need to really address this, really hit home with this. And then you see it again in the speech where he started talking about American politicians had gone mad on war. He told the crowd that the war had affected children. So far we have killed 1 million of them, mostly children. They wander into towns and see thousands of the children homeless, without clothes, running in packs on the streets like animals. They see the children degraded by our soldiers as they beg for food. Again, he's raising the stakes here. Nothing more universal than how we care about our children, how we want our children to have everything that they desire. I mean, I know I can, you know, say that. He also touched on his relationship with God, saying, I speak as a child of God and brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. This speech is considered by many as one of his greatest. At the time, not so much, but today, it's seen as forward-thinking, as ahead of his time, which he was, which is why we really need to look at this guy, right? It's a far cry from the idealistic dream that he talked about 3 years before, but it was still rooted in some of those same beliefs. He had not wavered on his position. He had matured. He had seen it from another perspective. This is where we get into to the radical king, a different king, person who was trying to address the issues of the world through other lenses, but he was still the same when it came to nonviolence and it came to the people didn't like what he had to say. The newspapers came out with editorials, with different civil rights groups, Ralph Bunche, veterans, all of them spoke out against King's speech, saying that you could not tie civil rights and the war and Vietnam, that they were two separate issues. King would say, no, they're not. They're interconnected. Of course, whatever affects me affects someone else wherever they are. He used to talk about it, this whole John Donne philosophy of, you know, no one is an island unto themselves, each one is a part of the main, right? Despite this criticism, despite being told that he should not do this, he still marched. He still marched against the war. He still linked it to the civil rights movement. He still linked it to poverty. And this is where you see the most powerful part about King is when, and we'll talk more about this in the end, when he made a decision, he never wavered. He always stayed true to that. Now, this brings us into the final piece here, when we're looking at his teachings and the Poor People's Campaign. It brings him to Memphis, Tennessee in early 1968. Now, this was part of a sanitation worker strike where people were marching with signs saying, I am a man, looking to be recognized as a person. And King believed that this was also linked to his Poor People's Campaign and went down there and marched with them. Now, on April 3rd, he had been back and forth in Memphis, but on April 3rd, he had been called to Mason Temple to give a speech. And at first, he didn't want to go. At first, he had been working all day. Ralph Abernathy went there to speak with people. And Reverend Abernathy that said, look, you need to come down here. You need to talk, all right? They want to see you. So he comes down, and he gives what would be his last major address. And that address, known as the Mountaintop Speech, filled with emotion. We're going to watch just a little bit of it, the very end of it. And I want you to watch how he talks, listen to what he's saying, and try to understand that emotion. And we'll talk more about that in a minute.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. So just as I say we aren't gonna let any dogs or water hoses turn us around, we aren't gonna let any injunction turn us around. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
The one image that always gets me when I see this is how he collapses into Ralph Abernathy's arms, with his hands by his side, as if he was just utterly exhausted. The man who has brought these his notions of nonviolence, his whole philosophy to the people to try to evoke change, and he was still fighting, and he just collapses into Abernathy's arms. In that speech, you can almost see he has all this energy, all this emotion. And if he actually, if you watch the whole speech, he talks about the movement and where it had come from, how he had gotten to that point. And he talks about how a little girl sent him a letter. He had been stabbed, actually, late 1950s. He was in New York City, and he had been stabbed by a woman. And the tip of the blade was on on an artery, and if he sneezed, he could have died. And this little girl said, "I'm just happy that you didn't sneeze, because you know now you were able to bring us this far." And then he says, "I'm happy I didn't sneeze either, because you know now I'm here with you." Now that's a very prophetic speech, also, where he talks about coming to the mountaintop and seeing the promised land, where the next day is when he's viciously taken from us. And this is a picture of him just before he was assassinated with his friends on the balcony at the hotel in Memphis, Tennessee. And suddenly, in an instant, a voice in that chorus of the movement was silenced forever. Now, news of his death resulted in major riots around the country. In Indianapolis, Senator Robert Kennedy, these two have worked together, and I've written a lot about this, they've worked together from afar, and they were even together in some ways, and they often battled too. So don't think that it was some really great friendship, but they often battled. But my point is, they knew each other, and Bobby Kennedy at this point in his life had started to appreciate King and started to appreciate the ideals that he exemplified. Now, in Indianapolis, Bobby Kennedy found out about his death. John Lewis was actually on Bobby Kennedy's campaign. And he had this speech already scheduled. And the people there had not heard that Dr. King had been assassinated. So Bobby Kennedy told him for the first time. And he said from the back of a pickup truck, without any written remarks, "Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice for his fellow human beings, and he died because of that effort." And Kennedy went on to talk about King's legacy. And his last remarks, which I'm going to play for you, is something that we can use in this forum today. The last 2 minutes of his speech, he talks about where we could go. And you see now Bobby Kennedy is starting to contribute to that chorus of voices that King had affected.
What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black. We can do well in this country. We will have difficult times. We've had difficult times in the past. but we will have difficult times in the future. It is not the end of violence. It is not the end of lawlessness, and it's not the end of disorder. But the vast majority of white people and the vast majority of black people in this country want to live together, want to improve the quality of our life, and want justice for all human beings that abide in our land. Dedicate ourselves to what the Greeks wrote so many years ago, to tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of this world. Let us dedicate ourselves to that and say a prayer for our country and for our people. Thank you very much.
Now, Bobby Kennedy's words started to resonate in the same way that Dr. King's did. He actually took a day off from his campaign and just wanted to talk about violence and wanted to talk about, he held a whole forum just on that. Kennedy, of course, would be assassinated 2 months later. I was just saying to my wife, it truly is remarkable that you have these three individuals in the 1960s that represented all these different ideals and all these things that we hope to attain, and all three of them were viciously, that being President Kennedy as well. All right, now, what can we take away from this exercise today? We just went through King's words. How can we use the themes, imagery, and emotion prevalent in those words to guide us in this endeavor to realize his dream? This is what I take from it. And I've already alluded to some of it, but let's sort of sum up. This is like my conclusion. King had severe determination and commitment to his beliefs. He took time, he listened, he asked a lot of questions before he made statements. Once he decided that position, he never wavered. This is an important lesson, I think, for all of us to really consider and reflect upon. It's important to listen, it's important to make a stand on things, and once you make that stand, try to stay true to it. He stayed true to nonviolence. He understood that, despite the fact that everybody told him that we needed to do more. The second thing, King didn't care what other people thought about his beliefs. I think that is, first of all, that's something that we tell our own children. You know, who cares what other people think? Well, King actually didn't, because he believed what he was doing was God's will. He believed what he was doing was right. Despite opposition in Birmingham and after his Vietnam speech, he didn't change his position. I think it was Abraham Lincoln who used to say that time is a good thickener of things. Such is the nature of history. Because now we look at King, where at one point he was considered a dangerous person, quote unquote. And today we celebrate his vision. His vision endures because he truly was a person ahead of his time. He understood where we needed to go. The third thing that I take from this is the emotions that we examine contribute to a chorus of voices in this movement. And his leadership on nonviolence and interconnectedness are timeless. We can use them today. And the emotions were natural. They were a part of what he was trying to do to evoke change and to evoke a reaction. It affected many Americans, this movement, and gave voice to a group that had been marginalized within history and is still marginalized today. So what can we do moving forward? Well, what I try to do is I bring my kids to see Dr. King. Since this memorial has been open, I've brought them every year, and I just want to recognize my wife over here, who has gone on these trips. Dr. Breen had mentioned, we had met here, and our three children are reared in Dr. King, Bobby Kennedy, John Kennedy in the 60s. So we have taken them to all sorts of places, and I certainly wouldn't be here if it were not for her. So I endeavor to make King's vision a part of my daily routine so that we talk about him in our household the way that we would talk about the Boston Red Sox. And you know, So we're Sox fans, in case you were wondering. So for the last 10 years, I've taken students to Washington. In fact, I don't know if I, Josh, did you go to Washington? You didn't, right? I know Gracie did back there because we actually went to her grandfather's grave over at Arlington National Cemetery. That was a great trip. I ask you to consider what you can do to contribute to this conversation. It's an important conversation. And if we were to look at Dr. King's words and learn from them, we can take those ideas and bring them to the table, create a new single garment of destiny. And I think that's important. And contribute to a new chorus, especially you students, that honors the many voices that exist in our own time. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share my thoughts on one of my heroes in history. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Providence College Podcast. Episodes can be found at all the usual places, as well as the college's YouTube channel and on your smart speaker. For producer Chris Judge, I'm Liz Kay. Until next time.